Tigray, Ethiopia has driven over 70,000 refugees in impoverished eastern Sudan. The United Nations agencies and aid groups struggle to evacuate them from the border and provide them with shelter. Millions are at risk of starvation as the brutal civil war in Tigray is reaching a turning point, with thousands of captured Ethiopian government troops arriving in the region. Tigray has been in the scene of fighting since Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed sent army in early November to topple the dissident regional authorities, which emerged from the Tigray People's Liberation Front. After early successes and a premature declaration of victory, government forces were bogged down in a vicious and months-long battle with pro-TPLF fighters. The Ethiopian army was backed by troops from the neighboring Amhara region and the army of Eritrea, which bordered Tigray.
The lengthy conflict between Ethiopian federal government and the Tigray front has already affected negatively not only Sudan and Ethiopia in particular, but also the Horn of Africa in general. This has prompted all the regional states to seek for a way to end the conflict in Ethiopia. Muhammad Ali Fazari, Khartoum.
This is the first time that three Iranian innovations have been approved and funded by the Global Innovation Exchange. Speaking at a press conference, head of Iran's national invention team said that the innovations have been evaluated by such international organizations as USAID, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundations before they receive the funds. Global Innovation Exchange is a global development technology platform for innovations, funding and insights. The three Iranian innovations include the genetics of success by Mohammad Aryan Akberi, which is one of the top ideas, which introduces a new formula to predict an individual's likelihood of success and could raise $187,500 fund from Turkey. And the next project is a smart hospital project by Amir Abbas Mohammadi Kushki, which has managed to attract $2 million fund. The third Iranian project approved by the Global Innovation Exchange has been proposed by Zahra Ghazavi, which is a cuffless blood pressure measuring device based on light sender and receiver sensors. Moreover, Iran's national invention team has won several shining medals at Turkey's Global Innovation and Invention Contest, Technofest 20 and ISIF 20, which were held by the World Intellectual Property Organization and the International Federation of Inventors Association, in association with Turkish Ministry of Economy and Turkish Intellectual Property Organization. In this round of competitions, Amir Abbas Mohammadi Kushki won silver medal for its smart robot preventing coronavirus. Dr. Aryan Akberi backed bronze medal for his genetics of success formula, and Zahra Ghazavi won silver medal for her blood pressure measuring device. Moreover, for the first time, two Iranian innovations have made way into MIT University Global Challenge Solve MIT, which have been published on its website.
This is the first time that a number of Iranian innovations have been well received at Global Innovation Exchange and have attracted international funds to develop the projects. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
I do hereby declare that Kim Michelle Leadbeater is duly elected.
The UK Labour Party secured a narrow win in the key by-election constituency of Batley and Spen in northern England. The results announced early Friday morning shocked many, as Labour was tipped to lose the seat to either the ruling Conservatives or Workers' Party GB candidate George Galloway.
The battle for Batley appears to have left a bitter taste after accusations of racism, harassment and even dirty tricks has circled the headlines over the past couple of weeks, with Batley's Muslim community also apparently playing a key role after turning their backs on the Labour Party over perceived policy injustices regarding Palestine and Kashmir.
Amid accusations of poster vandalism by Labour activists, Mr. Galloway vowed legal action.
We have been multiply defamed to the point that I'm no longer prepared to talk with the mainstream media, which is why I'm talking to you now by this live stream. The whole election campaign was dominated by lazy and false tropes about our campaign, about the thousands of people that voted for us, about their motives for doing so, in a way which defamed them as much as it defamed me.
Despite Labour's win, experts claim Muslims still sent a strong message by removing their traditional loyal support.
So Muslims, this is an opportunity to build alliances with the voiceless in our wider communities. And for those who are outside of the Muslim community, look at us as your allies. We want to flex our political muscles and we are happy to do so alongside you, inshallah.
Despite Labour's win, British Muslims remain deeply frustrated. This aspect could affect future votes unless the party changes its policy towards Muslims dramatically. Robert Carter, London.
Bagram Military Air Base in northern Parwan province was known as an American town since it was considered as the biggest US military base in Afghanistan. Now, no American troop is in Bagram and it has been handed over to the Afghan government. Both the Afghan government and the Taliban have welcomed the move. However, the militant group says the withdrawal of US forces from Afghanistan's Bagram air base is a hasty escape and the rising Taliban attacks across the country. Meanwhile, many Afghans say the withdrawal needs to be viewed as a chance to remove violence from the country.
Political players in Afghanistan need to view the withdrawal of foreign troops as a big opportunity to end violence here. Both government and the Taliban must now get back to negotiations to settle the problems.
Afghan officials have always blamed the Taliban for waging war under the pretext of fighting foreign invasion. And now they call on the Taliban to logically decide on the fate of their own war-torn homeland.
If the excuse was foreign troops' presence, they are leaving now. Other issues such as ignoring the Republic or the Constitution by the Taliban don't make sense anymore. Challenges such as corruption could now be discussed peacefully. So we expect the Taliban to respect the nation's demand and responsibly resume intra-Afghan talks.
Some 9,600 foreign troops should leave Afghanistan by September 11. A deadline set by US President Joe Biden, who seeks to end America's longest war. It was launched in 2001 under the pretext of fighting terrorism. However, no peace has been achieved yet, and thousands of Afghans have lost their lives since then. Afghan officials say government forces are fully ready to independently defend the country amid withdrawal of foreign troops. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The city of Qom marks the end of a week-long occasion known as the U.S. Human Rights Week. The annual event commemorates a series of tragic incidents that killed hundreds of Iranians. The last day of the week, which falls on July the 3rd, marks the 1988 shooting down of an Iranian airliner by the U.S. Navy, which killed all of the 290 people on board. After more than three decades, Iran is still waiting for an apology from the U.S. The American Human Rights Week also commemorates the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of Iran's Islamic Republic Party, carried out by the formidable Mujahideen-e-Khalq terrorist organization, known as the MKO. 73 leading officials, including the then Justice Chief Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti, were killed in the terror attack. In 2012, the U.S. and Europe delisted the MKO as a terrorist entity, and since then, they have been holding regular meetings with the terror group, which is now based in France and Albania. The 1987 chemical bombardment of Iran's city of Sardasht is another incident that falls in the same period on the Iranian calendar. Iraq's chemical weapons were reportedly produced using materials supplied by the U.S. and other Western countries. The 1981 attempted assassination of the then Iranian president Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei by the MKO is also among the incidents that's marked in the American Human Rights Week. Iran says the U.S. footprints can be traced in all of the incidents that fall in this fateful week. Activists here say Washington has so far shrugged off its crimes in Iran. And that is why Iran marks the American Human Rights Week every year to present documented instances of gross violations of human rights by the U.S., at least in Iran. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Qom.
Over 1 month since a ceasefire came into force between the Israeli regime and Hamas, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip still suffer from psychological trauma and feel unsafe. While fears are rising of another round of violence, Palestinians mark 15 years of a land, air and sea Israeli blockade that has devastated Gaza's economy and caused widespread destruction, leaving most people largely cut off from the outside world.
The Israeli blockade imposed for 15 years led Palestinians to call for simple solutions. This blockade, of course, affected all life aspects, especially the rate of poverty and unemployment. There are many graduates who are jobless now. Wars and Israeli blockade isolated Gaza from the world, and it's not surprising that many countries know nothing about Gaza.
Israeli blockade imposed on the Gaza Strip affected badly on all life aspects, leading to high rates of poverty and unemployment. Most of the working-age population in the Gaza Strip are unemployed and without any source of income due to the lack of job opportunities.
There are a lot of graduated people without a job in Gaza. The unemployment rate is high and there are no job opportunities. For 15 years, we have been living in the same situation. There has been continuous escalations and war over Gaza, and people will suffer from everything and nothing changes.
Due to the limited sources and restrictions imposed in movement and entry of goods and fuel, only a limited amount of fuel and cooking gas reach homes and the electricity plant. As a result, Gazans are suffering an electricity crisis that has devastated daily life, especially on clean water, as people in Gaza suffer from salty and polluted water that is not fit for drinking. Both the continuous violence over the Strip and the Israeli blockade affected badly on every aspect of life for Palestinians, isolating and depriving them from their rights. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. Mm-hmm.
the supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
The Spotlight.
Lebanon's caretaker Prime Minister has appealed to the international community to save his country that he's warning is only a few days from a social explosion. The World Bank has called the crisis in the Arab country one of the worst depressions of modern history. National currency has lost most of its value, pushing more than half of the population into poverty. To make matters worse, politicians have not been able to agree on a new government since August 4th. When a huge explosion hit Beirut port. Now, what are the underlying reasons for the situation? Anything can be done about it?
An economic crisis came under the spotlight in Lebanon in October 2019 after the then government of Saad Hariri proposed plans to raise new taxes on tobacco, petrol, and voice calls via messaging services such as WhatsApp. The Hariri government sought to drum up more revenue amid a shortage of foreign currency. But the plans led to mass protests against economic turmoil and corruption. Eventually, the plans were called off and the government stepped down. But the financial situation continued to worsen amid the coronavirus pandemic. Hariri's successor, Hassan Diab, also resigned after a deadly explosion at the Beirut port in August 2020 that caused billions of dollars of damage. The Lebanese currency has so far lost more than 90% of its value, and more than half of the population has been sunk into poverty, as the country also faces severe fuel shortages. In the wake of the deepening economic crisis, Diab, who is a caretaker premier now, warned on Tuesday that Lebanon is only days away from what he called a social explosion. Diab, whose country has failed to form a new government in almost 11 months, also urge foreign donors to release financial aid to save the nation and do not link it to the government formation.
Linking aid to Lebanon with government formation has started to threaten the lives of people and to the Lebanese entity because the pressures that are being exercised and the siege imposed on Lebanon do not affect the corrupt. Instead, it is the Lebanese people who pay the heavy price that threatens their lives and their future.
On Monday, the Secretary General of the Hezbollah resistance movement blamed the United States for economic crises. Syed Hassan Nasrallah said Washington is wielding the threat of sanctions against the Lebanese government to prevent it from receiving aid from other countries. Talks over the formation of a new cabinet have stalled as President Michel Aoun and Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri remain at loggerheads over the coming government's makeup and reform agenda. This comes as the U.S. and some of its Western and regional allies are at odds with Beirut over the role of Hezbollah in Lebanon's politics. The resistance movement and its allies now hold the majority of parliamentary seats following elections in 2018. Irrespective of the ongoing crisis in Lebanon, the country's main woes are rooted in the power-sharing system, which is a legacy of the French colonialism. Nonetheless, many are worried that the political vacuum and chaos in Lebanon could plunge the Mediterranean nation into a new civil war like the one it experienced for 15 years until 1990.
Now, welcome to the Spotlight. Joining me in tonight's show that has to do with the Lebanon situation will be Professor of the Lebanese International University, Jamal Wakim, in Beirut. And also journalist and political commentator, Saeed Mohsen Abbas, in London. Now, welcome to the show, both gentlemen. Let's go to Lebanon first. Professor Wakim, what's going on in Lebanon? You know, the country has been in crisis for more than a year. What are the root causes of the crisis in that country?
Well, there are several reasons, but mainly the main reason is American pressures on Lebanon, on Lebanese economy, in order to force the political elite to isolate Hezbollah as part of the U.S. plan to draw Lebanon under its influence, fully under its influence, at a time when it's planning to dissolute the Palestinian cause, force the neighboring countries of Palestine to neutralize the refugees, give them nationalities and settle them in their country, and prevent the Palestinian refugees from their right to return to their homeland, and at the same time marginalize Lebanon and make it like a dependent state, a state dependent on Israel, like a buffer zone for Israel. And that's why Hezbollah stands, and some of its allies stand, as an obstacle to these geopolitical plans of the United States. And that's why the United States is pressuring the country to go on the brink of collapse in order to implement its agenda, even if it's at the expense of its own proxies in the country. So that's why the political elite and the economic elite that have been dependent on the West for too long, since the 17th and 18th century, they cannot dare, they wouldn't dare, to choose to seek alternatives to Western tutelage over the country. That's why they refused all help coming from Russia, from Iran, and from China so far, because they know they were even threatened by the United States, that they know where their assets are hidden, financial assets, bank assets, and Western banks, and they can confiscate them. And here I'm talking about 80% of the political elite and the economic elite, including all of 14th of March coalition and part of March 8th coalition, by the way. Even some allies of Hezbollah, too bad, we need to admit this.
Now, turning to London, said Mohsen Abbas, the U.S. has also imposed a number of sanctions. Speaking of banks, Professor Joachim mentioned, it's not only banks, it's also individuals and Lebanese central banks. So how serious have the U.S. sanctions impacted the Lebanese economy?
Of course, it's very serious. In fact, Lebanon's GDP plummeted from close to U.S. $55 billion in 2018 to an estimated U.S. $33 billion in 2020. So you can see a major collapse there, while the GDP per capita fell by around 40% in dollar terms. All this is subject to extraordinarily high uncertainty. So the real GDP is this year projected to contract by a further 9.5%. Now, this is not an accident. This is engineered economic terrorism. And this is what the levers of power of the money mafias that run most of the global, if you like, control mechanisms are involved in. They do it time and time again. They've done it in Venezuela. They've been doing it to the Islamic Republic of Iran. If you look at Russia, even China is not, averse for them to lean on. So this is neoliberal imperialism, using economic terrorism to subjugate people. There are lots of different ways of subjugating people. It's not just a military boots on the ground effort. Of course, the Americans learned their lesson in Lebanon when they went scuttling out of Lebanon after one attack by the Lebanese resistance at that time back in the days post-Civil War. Nobody wants to go back to civil war in Lebanon, but they tasted what that was about for, near on a decade, if not more, where there was absolute murder and mayhem within the nation. Now, the most responsible force within all of this that I can see is the one that is being targeted primarily by these neoliberal, if you like, forces inside Lebanon, working for the external Zio-Western imperialist forces, and that is Hezbollah. People like Mustafa Aluj, former MP of Lebanon, are on record as openly regarding Hezbollah as the primary foe of Lebanon. Absolutely laughable, really, but these people exist in the Lebanese political circumstances, and yet the responsibility that Hezbollah has shown, in spite of its abilities militarily, in not interfering directly in any kind of belligerent way in Lebanese politics is pretty admirable. And I think what Hassan Nasrallah has said, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, has said this week is very, very important. You know, he alluded in his recent speech at a conference concerning the worsening economic crisis in Lebanon. He blamed the U.S., saying it's American policy that's the main reason for the crisis, and that the Americans want to besiege, punish, and prevent any aid that comes to Lebanon. This is exactly what's happening. He's admitted that there are incorrect government policies, and those are part of the causes of the economic crisis. But of course, the people who've been running the show, the likes of Hariri, are essentially sellouts. They're in Saudi Arabian pockets, which are in the pockets of the Americans. So to be honest with you, Lebanon has got an internal political corruption issue, which is the primary problem, in my opinion. And of course, as my colleague pointed out, there is a solution. First of all, resistance, economics, getting rid of these neoliberal IMF, World Bank threats and subjugation to them is the first thing that needs to happen, and a reliance more eastwards towards Iran, which is ready to supply oil and gas, and the likes of China and Russia and others. I think that's the direction, but only if these corrupt politicians can first be brought to book.
Okay. Now, Professor Joachim, it's also the EU. The EU is threatening Lebanon, and at the time the country is on the verge of collapse. And so what's the role of Europe, especially France, in the current crisis besetting Lebanon?
Well, France is dependent on the U.S., has been dependent on the U.S. for too long. First, since ousting General Charles de Gaulle in the late 1960s, by the first maybe colored revolution of the time. And of course, after 2004, with the famous Normandy summit between Jacques Chirac and George W. Bush in June 2004. So France fully came under American tutelage, and it's only implementing policies that go by the interests, the geopolitical interests of the United States, in the hope of getting a fraction of the spoils of war. So that's regarding France. Of course, Western Europe, the European Union, is under U.S. influence, and of course is integrated into the monetary system that is dominated by the United States. That's why they will, they cannot but implement policies that go or that are, let's say, approved by the American agenda. So the Europeans, and mainly France, is an accessory of the United States in the region. The Macron, the French president, Emmanuel Macron, posed as the facilitator of implementing American strategy at one point, that he could do or he could succeed where others failed. So he had a green light by the Americans, but on the condition of isolating Hezbollah and bringing Lebanon under full American hegemony, which didn't occur, and this was the reason why the French initiative failed in the first time. So I believe that the Europeans don't have an independent role. They are mere accessories to the U.S. strategy, and they, even if it was at the expense of the European national security, because the Europeans would be one of the primary party affected by instability in Lebanon, with the influx of refugees from Lebanon, instability that could affect also neighboring countries, including nearby Cyprus, or even it could affect Greece with the refugee issue. So all this is disregarded by the European Union in order to please the United States at, and its geopolitical agenda in leading hostile policies against what it considers as its competitors at world hegemony, mainly Russia, Iran, and China.
Okay. So, Mohsen Abbas, in the middle of all of these issues, we have the problem of forming a new government, and Prime Minister Desni Sadhari has failed to form a cabinet. What's the catch? I mean, why aren't the Lebanese leaders unable to reach a consensus over forming a new government?
Well, because half of them, or, well, perhaps not half, but certainly a large number of them, have got their fingers in the corruption pie and are totally and utterly linked to external forces, largely Saudi and, of course, what I call Zio-Arabian connections. They're getting direct funding, and that's what maintains their sort of daily bread and butter, and they're not willing to let that go. They are also, of course, with the threat, as we mentioned earlier, from American, you know, access to their accounts, etc. So, to be fair, I mean, these chaps, unless there is a what I call a night of the long knives, in a way, purging of such corrupt politicians, Lebanon's situation will remain stagnant. I mean, they are the ones who are stagnating it absolutely deliberately. It's so hypocritical that they've not even been able to get to the bottom of what happened at the port in Beirut port, the explosion that took place. Hezbollah and the Secretary General of Hezbollah have said time and time again that they want answers and want clarity about what went on. The report seems to be going on and on, but what we know is that these kinds of incidents are being engineered to make Lebanon come to its knees, because the fundamental factor is that Lebanon is, or certainly Hezbollah, is the only force to have defeated Israel toe-to-toe, militarily, on the ground. And I think that everybody knows very clearly that it is Hezbollah that needs to be destabilized by Israel, and Israel is using the American economic leverage, sanctioning leverage and threats to try to essentially secure itself. I mean, it's a forlorn cause, because ultimately, Hezbollah have been able to exercise their newfound muscle in the places like Iraq and Syria, essentially being a major factor in rescuing the sovereignty of those nations mm-hmm. at a time when the ISIS, the Israeli-American unleashed attack dogs, ISIS, were about to overrun those nations. Essentially, they have been the primary force that went in and not only trained but fought and gave lives of the Lebanese resistance to prevent Lebanon itself collapsing, because we also saw these forces moving into Lebanon. So, in fact, Hezbollah is the one factor which keeps Lebanon, if you like, from being overrun as a vassal state of American and Israeli, if you like, imperialism. Yet you've got these people who would rather side with the likes of Benny Gantz. And in fact, I'd just like to say that he actually laughably offered humanitarian aid to Lebanon this week, saying, as an Israeli, as a Jew, and as a human being, my heart aches seeing the images of people going hungry on the streets of Lebanon.
Right.
I mean, it's almost so hilarious, you could laugh at it. This is an Israel which invaded Lebanon more than twice, has tried to annex Lebanon, is the first domino to fall in the Ginon plan, which they constantly push in the area. And yet here he is bleeding his heart out about how he's concerned about Lebanon. Well, you know, we know Lebanon's suffering from a worsening economic crisis because of these people,
okay.
Because of the violence and the protests and the false flag operations and the psyops that they're carrying on constantly against this nation, violating its sovereignty in terms of the airspace. You know, their flights of the Israeli airplanes go over regularly to bomb the likes of Syria. You know, and of course, anything that happens, any protests that break out in this city, really, ultimately, are all at the line. At the foot of Israelis and the Americans,
okay,
who are causing this kind of
okay,
intervention.
We're running fast out of time. Let me put this question to Professor Wakim. You know, there is a plethora of problems the country facing. National currency has lost 90% of its value. Fuel prices have risen by 50%. Food prices have tripled. Pharmaceuticals are hoarded. Majority of people have only 2 hours of electricity. Who's to blame for this?
Well, of course, we have to blame the corrupt political and economic elite that is tightening its grip on the country with the support of the West mainly. 90% of the political elite in Lebanon is directly or indirectly linked to the West and takes its instructions from the West, except for Hezbollah and tiny groups in Lebanon. So, of course, corruption. The backward political system that is running the country, that has been running the country for the past two centuries, I mean confessionalism, but also the mercantile elite that is imposing its full control of the economy through the banks, the financial system, which amounts to 90% of the Lebanese economy. And this sector is fully in the hands of the Americans. And when they wanted to switch off the light on the country, they did it with few sanctions that led to the banking system to collapse its knees, and with it the whole Lebanese economy that depends on the banking system alone.
Okay.
So that's why this is what happened, and I believe that we don't have an alternative too bad with an alternative lead to build mm-hmm. an alternative model, and in order to confront the American attempt at imposing their geopolitical agenda on the country and in the
okay.
region.
Now, on that note, we'll come to the end of this show, Spotlight Show. So let me thank our guests, we have Professor of the Lebanese International University, Jamal Wakim in Beirut, and journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas in London with their contribution. And that's it for this edition of the Spotlight. I've been your host, Behrouz Najib. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The blaze first swept across parched fields of guinea grass. Then the flames got so close to Emma Lee Gerrish's house that she feared for her life. "I was terrified it was going to jump the gulch," said Miss Gerrish, a 26-year-old whose Quaker family raises cows and sheep in the hills above Pauilo, a ranching outpost on Hawaii's Big Island. "I've never seen a fire this large in my lifetime." The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Simon Romero. The piece is titled, "How Bad Are U.S. Wildfires? Even Hawaii is Battling a Surge." The blaze first swept across parched fields of guinea grass, then the flames got so close to Emily Gerrish's house that she feared for her life. "I was terrified it was going to jump the gulch," said Miss Gerrish, a 26-year-old whose Quaker family raises cows and sheep in the hills above Pauilo, a ranching outpost on Hawaii's Big Island. "I've never seen a fire this large in my lifetime." By the time firefighters got to the wildfire under control last month, with a mix of helicopters dropping water while residents drove bulldozers to create fire breaks, more than 1,400 acres of land had been burned, adding to the tens of thousands across the state since 2018. Hawaii may be graced with tropical forests, making parts of the island some of the wettest places on the planet, but it is also increasingly vulnerable to wildfires. Heavy rains encourage unfettered growth of invasive species like guinea grass, and dry, hot summers make them highly flammable. Similar to the American West, where dozens of large blazes have raged in recent weeks and fire seasons have grown worse over the years because of extreme weather patterns and climate change, about two-thirds of Hawaii faces unusually dry conditions this summer. Some of the recent fires, especially on the Big Island and the island of Maui, ravaged areas spanning some 10,000 acres. Since 2018 through to last year, At least 75,107 acres of land across the islands have been lost to wildfires, by far the worst, the most devastating stretch in a decade and a half. While the wildfires showcase several challenges that Hawaii shares with states in western United States, including the spread of highly flammable invasive grasses, the authorities in Hawaii also cite other factors that make Hawaii unique. Those include big shifts in rainfall patterns over the archipelago and tourism's eclipse of large-scale farming in Hawaii's economy, allowing non-native plants to overtake idled sugarcane and pineapple plantations. Firefighters also have to operate across exceptionally diverse climate zones, extinguishing blazes everywhere from thick tropical forests to semi-arid scrublands to chilly elevations where frost can be seen on trees along the slopes of Mauna Kea volcano. Even before the latest surge, the area burnt annually in Hawaii by wildfires had already climbed fourfold from previous decades, according to Clay Trauernicht, a tropical fire specialist at University of Hawaii at Manoa. Mr. Trauernicht, who analyzed more than a century's worth of wildfire records, also found that the area burnt each year in Hawaii from 2005 to 2011 was about 0.48% of the state's total land area, roughly the same as in fire-prone western states under mainland United States during the same period. More than 60% of land across Hawaii is currently considered abnormally dry, according to the National Drought Mitigation Center, and the vegetation in some of the pasture lands and fallow plantations on the Big Island has the yellow-hued look of arid ranches in western United States. Even so, greater rainfall during the state's winter or wet season may be just as responsible for Hawaii's growing wildfires. A lot of rain helps grass species such as guinea grass and kikuyu thrive. Both were introduced to the state decades ago as both forage for livestock and to curb erosion. Some grow up to 6 inches in a day and provide fuel for fires to quickly leap out of control. Before this year brought dry conditions across much of the state, last winter figured among the wettest in 3 decades. The biomass out there is off the charts, Mr. Trauernicht said. When you have a huge wet winter, that will influence fire risk to a greater degree than the actual drought conditions. Volcanic eruptions and tsunamis also threaten Hawaii, but natural causes such as lightning or flowing lava account for only a small fraction of wildfires in the state, according to fire prevention officials. Instead, people ignite more than 90% of wildfires on Hawaii. The results can be disastrous for native species steeped in the island's culture, like the ohia, a tree that grows easily on new lava flows, featuring flowers which are often scarlet red. In 2018, for instance, a worker repairing a bulldozer with a plasma cutter, a tool used to cut metal, accidentally sparked a blaze that spread into the Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. The fire burnt 3,572 acres of land of largely native forest. Some of these invasive species are actually colonizing barren lava flows, taking away these natural fuel breaks, said Greg Funderburk, the park's fire management officer. Now we have a sea of grass in what would have been barren rock with sparse ohia trees. While the cause of the fire in Pauilo last month remains under investigation, the blaze in a rural area that normally has wetter weather this time of year and where wildfires were once a rarity has alarmed officials. Adding to concerns, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration warned in its latest forecast that drought conditions should intensify this summer on the Big Island in Hawaii, as well as some other parts of the archipelago. authorities in at-risk areas are already pleading with residents to avoid watering yards or washing cars to conserve water. On Molokai, Hawaii's fifth largest island, residents are fretting about dry conditions after hundreds of axis deer were found dead of starvation last year. Hawaii's size, just larger than New Jersey, means that wildlife are often uncomfortably close to where people live. Kamilo Mora, a climate scientist at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, said that he watches from his backyard as a recent brush fire grew alarmingly fast before crews in helicopters could extinguish it. The expense of renting helicopters, which can cost more than $1,000 an hour, plus the geography of the state, an island chain in the Pacific Ocean, also weigh on the minds of firefighters. It's not like that mainland where you can drive in crews from other states, said Kevin Kaneshiro, a 37-year-old, the captain at the nearby fire station in Honokaa, which responded to the Pauilo fire. You have to make do with what you have here. Mr. Mora, who has a project to bolster native vegetation by planting thousands of trees around Hawaii, said that the spike in wildfire activity also stems from social problems, such as the island's acute housing shortage. Many of the wildfires here in Hawaii get triggered by the homeless, who mean no harm, Mr. Mora said. These people need to eat. They need to cook their own food. Next thing you know, a tiny accident triggers a wildfire. In Pauilo, residents remain unnerved by just how close to the recent wildfire got to their homes. Some areas alongside the fire's scar were still smoldering in late June, with residents calling the local fire station to extinguish the pop-up blazes. As if highlighting the risk, guinea grass has already begun sprouting on land blackened by the fire. Cole Ahuna, whose home was almost consumed by the wildfire, wondered what could happen if the grasses continue to grow and dry weather persists and the winds pick up again. The fire got all the way to the horse pasture before the dozers came and cut it off, said Mr. Cole Ahuna, a 19-year-old. Something like this was unheard of around here when I was growing up, but now it's a different world.
Beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.